Readers, welcome to the Book Report's special salute to Veterans Day. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm honored to present a collection of books written, in many cases, by those who served with distinction in our armed forces. If I may, I'd like to remember and salute my first cousin, Robert Pasikoff, an Air Force pilot in Vietnam shot down over Laos. He remains an MIA whose name appears among the 58,195 names on the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. That's a place, along with the other stirring memorials on the mall, worth revisiting. But right now, let's begin our literary tribute to the military as we turn to page one of the book report.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Admirals, by award-winning historian Walter Bornman, tells the story of the only 4 men in American history to have been promoted to the 5-star rank of Admiral of the Fleet: William Leahy, Ernest King, Chester Nimitz, and William Halsey. These men were the Navy's best and brightest, and together they led the U.S. Navy to victory in World War II. Bornman tells their story in full detail, drawing upon journals, ship logs, and other primary sources to show the ways they revolutionized naval warfare. Readers get the insider's look at how these men, both friends and rivals, worked together to ensure the Allied victory. Brian Troxell narrates.
The glistening white bow of the American battleship Oregon drove through wave after towering wave as the big ship clawed its way south through heavy seas. Its jackstaff at the bow routinely disappeared as fully 15 feet of blue water broke on the forward turret and threw white spray nearly the length of the ship. It was April 1898, and as the Oregon thundered toward the fabled Strait of Magellan, the air hung thick with rumors of war with Spain. In fact, in this era before radio communications, there was no way for the captain to know if war had already begun. By the standards of any contemporary navy, the Oregon was a major strategic weapon. The Union Ironworks of San Francisco had laid down its keel late in 1891 as the third in a line of Indiana-class battleships. At 348 feet in length, with a beam of 69 feet and a displacement of 10,288 tons, the ship was a beefy platform for a dazzling array of firepower, including 2 13-inch guns, each in the main fore and after turrets. Oregon and its older sisters, Indiana and Massachusetts, owed their existence to a belated post-Civil War awakening that the United States, having largely completed its expansion from sea to sea, should now be prepared not only to defend its interests, but also to seek other territory well beyond its borders. Not everyone, however, supported this creeping American imperialism. Many avowed isolationists in Congress wanted only coastal defenses and opposed offensive long-range battleships. The futurists in the U.S. Navy managed to paper over such disputes by calling this new generation of vessels seagoing coastline battleships. In addition to its armaments, the Oregon relied on a belt of 18-inch thick armor plating around its sides and thinner armor for its gun turrets and decking. The ship also had two other distinct advantages. It was fast for the time. Twin screws delivered better than 15 knots. And its spacious coal bunkers provided a range of more than 6,000 miles. Heavily armed, well protected, speedy, and long range, Oregon and its class were clearly the advent of a new generation of naval warfare. They could boast of being the first modern era battleships of the U.S. Navy. Among Oregon's complement of 32 officers and 441 enlisted men were six green naval cadets. They were 1897 graduates of the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, but not yet full-fledged ensigns, because the Navy required 2 years of sea duty before awarding commissions. Service aboard a first-class ship such as the Oregon was a plum assignment, even if some of the old hands tended to view the flocking cadets more as nuisance gnats than budding officers. The pulses of old salts and young greenhorns alike had quickened on March 19, 1898, as the battleship departed San Francisco and passed through the Golden Gate, its destination known only to its captain. After 4,700 miles and the traditional crossing the equator ceremony, Oregon steamed into Cayo, Peru. But ship and crew paused there only long enough to fill the coal bunkers to the brim and secure an extra 200 tons of coal in sacks on the decks. Rumors were rife that they might be headed for Honolulu or even the Philippines, but as Oregon cleared the harbor, it turned south toward the stormy seas around Cape Horn at the tip of South America. By the time another 3,000 miles had fallen astern, the Strait of Magellan beckoned, and an icy southerly gale whipped the battering waves ever higher. Under the onslaught of these gigantic seas, recalled Naval Cadet William D. Leahy, the ship dove, trembled, shook them off, and dove again. According to Leahy, we said she smelled the Spanish fleet.
We've just heard The Admirals by Walter Bornman. In July 2005, four U.S. Navy SEALs departed on a reconnaissance mission in the mountainous Afghanistan-Pakistan border region. Their task was to document the activity of an al-Qaeda leader rumored to have had a small army in a Taliban stronghold. 5 days later, only one of those Navy SEALs remained alive. Lone Survivor, the eyewitness account of Operation Red Wing and the lost heroes of SEAL Team 10, is the story of SEAL Team leader Marcus Luttrell. The book recounts the mission and the extraordinary firefight that led to the largest loss of life in American Navy SEAL history. Luttrell's squadmates fought valiantly beside him until he was blasted by an RPG into a place where his pursuers could not find him. Over the next 4 days, terribly injured and presumed dead, Luttrell crawled for miles through the mountains. He was taken in by sympathetic villagers who risked their lives to protect him from the Taliban. The book, written with Patrick Robinson, recounts the rigors of SEAL training, where Luttrell and fellow SEALs discovered what it took to join the elite of the American Special Forces. Two of Luttrell's squadmates were awarded the Navy Cross posthumously for combat heroism. Kevin Collins narrates this chronicle of courage and sacrifice, honor and patriotism.
This was payback time for the World Trade Center. We were coming after the guys who did it. If not the actual guys, then their blood brothers, the lunatics who still wished us dead and might try it again. Goodbyes tend to be curt among Navy SEALs. A quick back slap, a friendly bear hug, no one uttering what we're all thinking. Here we go again, guys, going to war, to another trouble spot, another enemy willing to try their luck against us. They must be out of their minds. It's a SEAL thing, our unspoken invincibility. The silent code of the elite warriors of the U.S. Armed Forces. Big, fast, highly trained guys, armed to the teeth, expert in unarmed combat, so stealthy no one ever hears us coming. SEALs are masters of strategy, professional marksmen with rifles, artists with machine guns, and, if necessary, pretty handy with knives. In general terms, we believe there are very few of the world's problems we could not solve with high explosive or a well-aimed bullet. We operate on sea, air, and land. That's where we got our name, U.S. Navy SEALs, underwater, on the water, or out of the water. Man, we can do it all. And where we were going, it was likely to be strictly out of the water. Way out of the water. 10,000 feet up some treeless moonscape of a mountain range in one of the loneliest and sometimes most lawless places in the world. Afghanistan. Bye, Marcus. Good luck, Mikey. Take it easy, Matt. See you later, guys. I remember it like it was yesterday. Someone pulling open the door to our barracks room, the light spilling out into the warm, dark night of Bahrain, this strange desert kingdom, which is joined to Saudi Arabia by the 2-mile-long King Fahd Causeway. The six of us, dressed in our light combat gear, flat desert khakis with Oakley assault boots, stepped outside into a light, warm breeze. It was March 2005. Not yet hotter than hell, like it is in summer, but still unusually warm for a group of Americans in springtime, even for a Texan like me. Bahrain stands on the 26-degree north line of latitude. That's more than 400 miles to the south of Baghdad. And that's hot. Our particular unit was situated on the south side of the capital city of Manama, way up in the northeast corner of the island. This meant we had to be transported right through the middle of town to the U.S. air base on Maharik Island for all flights to and from Bahrain. We didn't mind this, but we didn't love it either. That little journey, maybe 5 miles, took us through a city that felt much as we did. The locals didn't love us either. There was a kind of sullen look to them, as if they were sick to death of having the American military around them. In fact, there were districts in Manama known as Black Flag areas, where tradesmen, shopkeepers, and private citizens hung black flags outside their properties to signify Americans are not welcome. The black flags worked. We stayed well clear of those places. Nonetheless, we had to drive through the city in an unprotected vehicle over another causeway, the Sheikh Hamad, named for the Emir. They're big on causeways, and I guess they will build more since there are 32 other much smaller islands forming the low-lying Bahrainian archipelago, right off the Saudi western shore in the Gulf of Iran.
That was Lone Survivor by Marcus Luttrell. Upon assuming the presidency in 1953, Dwight Eisenhower came to be seen by many as a lightweight. Yet, behind the bland smile was a brilliant intellectual tactician. As Evan Thomas reveals in Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's secret battle to save the world, Ike was a master of calculated duplicity. Ike could be patient and ruthless in the con, and generous and expedient in his partnerships. Facing the Soviet Union, China, and his own generals, some of whom believed a first strike was the only means of survival, Eisenhower would make his boldest and riskiest bet yet, one of such enormity there could be but two outcomes, the survival of the world or its end. Brian Troxell narrates.
On February 7, 1953, Eisenhower wanted to play golf very, very badly, as his secretary, Ann Whitman, put it in her diary. The day was cold and rainy, and Ike kept wandering out of the Oval Office onto the porch by the Rose Garden to stare up at the clouds. "Sometimes," he told Whitman, "I feel so sorry for myself I could cry." Whitman knew her boss was not entirely exaggerating. It may have been the middle of winter, and Eisenhower had been in office less than 3 weeks, but golf was vital to him. Barred by his image-conscious handlers from venturing out on the links during the presidential campaign, he had been anxious to play as a way of dealing with the pressures of his work. Eisenhower had a healthy respect for the physical and mental toll exacted on the men who had occupied the Oval Office before him. "That damn job," he called the presidency when he was still a lowly staff officer in the 1930s based in Washington. "Hell, the job killed Woodrow Wilson," Ike had exclaimed to Mamie. As president, Eisenhower brought the same discipline to relaxation that he applied to everything else. Golf was essential to his daily routine. When he awakened in the morning, he limbered up by taking a few swings in his bedroom with his favorite 8-iron. He sometimes swung the club when dictating to Mrs. Whitman. At 5 o'clock p.m., he would rise from Teddy Roosevelt's old Navy Department desk in the Oval Office, put on his golf shoes, and head out the door, leaving tiny spike holes in the floorboards. On the Ellipse, the greensward stretching south from the White House toward the Washington Monument, he would practice fairway approach shots. His faithful valet, or as he was known in military parlance, his striker, Sergeant John Mooney, would shag the balls while tourists peered through the iron fence. Eisenhower teed off for a full round of golf about 800 times in his 8 years as president. Almost every Wednesday and Saturday afternoon, he played 3-hour, 18-hole rounds at Burning Tree, an all-male club in the Maryland suburbs. On 23 trips to Georgia, he played roughly 200 times at Augusta National, where friends built him, on the 10th hole, a spacious three-story house, known initially as Mamie's Cabin, then more commonly as the Eisenhower Cabin. Mamie herself never played, but approved of the game as a stress reliever for her husband. Ike was a respectable weekend golfer, usually shooting in the 80s, but he had a congenital fade and an unreliable putter, and he sometimes blew up with a torrent of hells and damnations. Ike almost never used stronger language, and he disapproved of off-color stories. He would turn and walk away if a friend unwittingly tried a dirty joke. The United States Professional Golf Association helped build a putting green and sand trap outside his office on the South Lawn in 1954. In the spring of 1955, when some unruly squirrels created divots in the green, Ike ordered them shot. Eisenhower was accustomed to having his wishes become commands, but in this case, the offending animals were caught and removed. Eisenhower had grown up poor in Abilene, Kansas. As Army Chief of Staff, he had an office larger than the house in which he had lived with his parents and four brothers. Uncomfortable with ostentatious luxury, during the war he disapproved of his lavish suite at London's Claridge's Hotel, with its gold and black sitting room, and moved out. "Makes me feel like I'm living in sin," he said. But he wore custom-made suits, donated by New York clothiers, and cheerfully loud golf clothes. "He never seemed to wear the same thing twice," recalled Arthur Larson. His clothes were carefully laid out every morning by Mooney. Dressing the president was a precise half-hour ritual. "It was like seeing somebody get ready for battle in the movies," said his grandson David, who as a boy watched with wonder. "He holds his hands out and puts his armor on, right plate armor, left plate armor." George Thompson, who filled in for Mooney on his days off, was astounded to find that he had to hold the president's undershorts for him to step into. Eisenhower was at once intimate and courtly with his staff. He rose when his secretary entered the room, and for the first 2 years addressed her as Mrs. Whitman. A tall, handsome woman in her early 40s, Ann Whitman could instantly sense the president's mood. Staffers would check with her in the morning for updates. As she revealed to her biographer Bob Donovan, she knew the president's likes and dislikes, that he enjoyed classical as well as cowboy music, though he was deathly afraid of being considered highbrow.
That was Ike's Bluff by Evan Thomas.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, No one looks at their brains, but it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain, and when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
Karna Small Bodman began her career as a TV reporter in San Francisco. She then anchored the news and covered breaking news stories throughout the Bay Area. She moved to Washington to anchor Channel 5's 10 o'clock news, host both a nationally syndicated program on business and economic issues, and a 3-hour news talk radio show. When Reagan was elected president, Karna was appointed Jim Brady's deputy press secretary. She worked closely with the National Press Corps, traveled extensively, and met with the president almost daily. Later, Karna became a senior director and spokesperson for the National Security Council. When Karna left to become senior vice president of a public affairs firm, she was the highest-ranking woman on the White House staff. By now, she had written TV news scripts, briefing papers for the president, newspaper columns, and magazine articles. But she always wanted to write novels. She's written 4, including the newest, Castle Bravo. Welcome, Karna. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
I'm delighted to be with you, Elaine. This is terrific.
Your background is so impressive. What was it like for you to face the press corps in the Reagan White House?
Daunting.
Not bad.
It really was. And of course, now today, things are even more challenging. I have sympathy, I'll put it that way, for any press operation, any administration. No, it really was tough. But on the other hand, the advantage that we had was working for a man like President Reagan, who was so gracious and so charming. And in fact, even people who didn't agree with his policies, they liked him, you know?
Yeah.
they really liked him.
Yeah. Let's get to the book. With your long and varied career in Washington, was there an actual event that inspired Castle Bravo?
It was inspired specifically by a conversation I had with a major general who was in charge of our entire missile defense force worldwide that I happened to meet and got to know. And he said, Karna, let me paint a scenario for you. Let's say it's a few years down the road, and some country that doesn't like us, or some militant group or something, somehow gets hold of a small nuclear device. Now, that's pretty doable, right? Well, I mean, they're all trying with proliferation issues worldwide. And let's say they also get hold of a little delivery vehicle. It could be as simple as a Scud missile. And I discovered recently you could procure a Scud missile on the black market from an arms dealer for about $100,000. So there you go, put them together. And they're off our coast someplace on some disguised fishing boat or something. And they're not going to aim it at Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York. But what they're going to do is aim it straight up in the air. And when you detonate even a small nuclear device up in the atmosphere, 50 miles up, which could be easy to shoot up on a Scud, it sets off something called an electromagnetic pulse. Think of shock waves emanating. And what that does, it doesn't kill people on the ground, but it fries all of the electronics on the ground. Elaine, I'll tell you, we would have no internet, no communications, no ATMs, no refrigeration, transportation, sanitation. And as the general looked at me, he said, Karna, it would set us back to the year 1910.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a scary scenario. So I just had to write a story about it. I did research and I created characters. My heroine works as the White House Director of Homeland Security, and she's very concerned about this, and there are some events overseas. So this is the story of Castle Bravo. I hope your listeners will want to read it.
Yeah. Well, you know, can we assume that your lead character, Samantha Reed, is based on an actual person and maybe even you?
Well, not me. I'm not that smart. Sometimes I think we create characters that we would like to be a little bit like them or have some of their facets, you know. In fact, I recall there was a great line. The terrific writer, Anne Tyler, was once asked, "Why do you write novels?" And I remember what she said. She said, "I write so they may experience more than one life."
Mm.
You know, you're creating all these characters with their goals and motivations and so forth. So yeah, we have our lead character. And then the love of her life is sent overseas to one of these problem areas, and we don't know whether he's going to get away or not. There's a great deal of tension in the book.
And with her dad, too.
And with her dad involved as well.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to talk about this kind of a threat, but not in a preachy way, of course. All these are mystery thrillers.
Mm.
And I recall another quote. George Bernard Shaw once said, "The best way to get your point across is to entertain."
Hmm.
So that's what we're trying to do with Castle Bravo.
Yeah. When I was reading this and thinking about, you know, you, when you were in D.C. and privy to all those national security threats, it must have been a really heavy burden. And with your background, even now, of course, you spend a lot of time thinking about national security much more than the regular folks. Do you ever wish you had chosen a different career path?
Oh, no. No. I was really so fortunate to be able to spend those 6 years in the Reagan White House, and I'm sure that people who have an opportunity to work in the White House of any administration consider that the high point of their career.
Right. And of course, I worked at the Library of Congress and spent, you know, many happy years on Capitol Hill. And I know from my own experience that there's so much that goes on that never makes it into the newspapers.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that we hope doesn't make it into the newspaper. But on the other hand, I'm grateful for freedom of the press, having worked with both sides of that as well.
Yeah. Have you heard from any associates from your D.C. days who may see themselves in one of your books?
Oh, sure. We talk about that a lot. In fact, I have talked to many of my former colleagues on the National Security Council to get information, do research. And I have one particular source who was with the FBI. And I even feature him and use his name.
Yeah. Well, your background, of course, is hard news. So how difficult was it to go from a strict style of reporting to writing fiction?
That was a challenge, Elaine. Let me tell you, for anyone who's thinking about writing a book out there, because in the beginning, I did a lot of writing, first news scripts and then columns and some articles. And then, of course, working in the White House, you're trying to boil everything down. You say, okay, let's get some talking points together in our Mideast policy and put them on one page.
Right.
Pretty much of a challenge. And then you're thinking about trying to put a whole story together, and you're trying to extrapolate out to 400 pages. And you get to about page 220 and say, where do I go from here? But it is a challenge to keep the tension going throughout the book and try to end every chapter with a hook.
Right.
And keep the reader reading. And I was really thrilled when Castle Bravo won an award at the Paris Book Festival. That was really exciting for me. Something you'd put on your website. And, oh, if I could mention, the website is karnabodman.com. K-A-R-N-A, because if anyone, any of your listeners wanted to send me an email, it's listed there on the contact page. I'd be delighted to send them an autographed book plate, their little book plates you peel off the backing and stick it in the book, and now you have an autographed book.
All right. And are you already working on the next book?
Oh, yes. In fact, I'm working on two of them.
Mm.
At the same time, sometimes you get a few ideas, and then I know that sounds a little weird, but I had an idea for these continuing characters, Samantha Reed and Trip Adams, and they are going to have yet a separate kind of a challenge, totally different challenge, different country involved, different bad guys. And that one, for that one, I've borrowed a phrase from the Reagan days. It's called Trust But Verify.
Mm.
And then separately, I had an idea for a much more lighthearted, more of a romantic suspense. Different characters, but just something lighthearted, sort of on the side. I think some authors can write in different genres. and have a good time with it. It would be more lighthearted. And that one is called Affairs of State. Well, finally, I want to thank you so much for having me on your show and giving me an opportunity to talk about Castle Bravo. And it recently just came out in audio, and I certainly hope they enjoy the story.
All right. Well, I know I enjoyed the story. Thanks so much for joining us today, Karna.
Thank you, Elaine.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
And now, let's hear a sampling of Castle Bravo, performed by Basil Sands.
But first, I'd like to know if any of you has a clue what you'd do if you actually did not know where your money was. You didn't know, so you couldn't get it. Not for food, not for medical care, not for anything. Her answer was met with half a dozen blank stares. She glanced down at a sheaf of notes she had in front of her and continued, "Let's say there was a massive power failure of some sort, and all the computers went down at once. None of the banks, the insurance companies, the hedge funds, nobody had any record of their deposits, their assets, their payment schedules, their debts. Then what?"
"Then they wait until the power comes back on," Jim said. "Besides, all the banks have backup systems. We have power failures all the time after hurricanes, earthquakes, whatever. So what's the big deal?"
"Backup systems? Some New York banks have backup systems in Jersey City. Too close," Samantha said with a wave of her hand. "No, what I'm asking you to consider is a situation where all of the computers, the stock market, the ATMs, the railroads, the cars, the hospitals with all of our new electronic medical records, the telephone system, the electricity grid, refrigeration, water treatment, in fact, everything using electronics, all of it is fried and won't work anymore. Not for a long while, maybe months, maybe as much as a year, until all the systems are repaired. No water, no food. Millions of Americans would die."
"Hey, Samantha, that's never happened. What are you talking about?" one staffer asked.
"I'm talking about an electromagnetic pulse," she said in a serious tone.
"EMP? You mean when a small nuke or one of those other e-weapons is detonated way up in the atmosphere and it sends out those magnetic waves, kind of like massive microwaves?" her deputy for energy and nuclear issues asked.
"Precisely," Samantha said.
"Okay, so the Pentagon has some of those new e-weapons," Jim volunteered. "In fact, remember at the beginning of the Iraq War, we knocked out an entire TV center in Baghdad with a single small E-bomb. Well, that's what they called it then. The Air Force dropped it to screw up their communications, but then we backed off." He stared at Samantha and pressed on. "So why are you bringing it up now when we've got so many other things to deal with? And besides, it's never happened except for that one time. At least not any other time that I can remember."
"Actually, it did happen a long time ago," she replied.
"When?" a chorus of voices intoned all at once.
"Okay, I know it was before any of us were born," Samantha said. "But I'm sure you all know about or have read about the series of nuclear tests our government conducted back in the 40s and 50s.
"Sure. Weren't they out in the Pacific somewhere?" the head of the executive secretariat asked.
"Yeah, the Marshall Islands," Jim said. "We weren't the only ones, though. The Russians, well, the Soviets, they tested weapons, too, in Central Asia. And a bunch of people were exposed to radiation, right?"
That was Castle Bravo by Karna Bodman.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
As we salute Veterans Day, we must also celebrate November 10th, the birthday of the Marine Corps. The Book Report's editor, Dave Hain, served in the Marines from 1989 to 1993 as a tank crewman with Delta Company tanks out of Camp Pendleton. Dave took part in Desert Storm and was stationed around the globe, including Japan and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It was Dave who asked me to share this great quote from Eleanor Roosevelt with you. "The Marines I have seen around the world have the cleanest bodies, the filthiest minds, the highest morale, and the lowest morals of any group of animals I have ever seen. Thank God for the United States Marine Corps." End quote. The Lions of Iwo Jima chronicles the bloodiest battle in Marine Corps history, claiming a third of all Marines killed in World War II. The relentless fighting lasted for 36 days. For Fred Haynes, a young captain in Combat Team 28, Mount Suribachi held an enemy of 22,000 warriors dug into caves and tunnels. By the time Haynes' unit had broken through the main Japanese resistance, 75% of three assault battalions, the frontline fighters who charged enemy positions, were gone. Many of the exhausted survivors were shattered. In 5 weeks, Combat Team 28 had advanced 5,600 yards, closed 2,088 caves, and lost 5,885 lives. Michael Pritchard narrates.
"The first unpleasant surprise was the black volcanic sand. Your feet sank deep into it with each step, and it was all but impossible to gain traction. Enemy fire at that point was heating up. The big stuff was joining the chorus of mortar and small arms fire we'd been taking since the first amphibious tractors came ashore at 0900. It was bedlam in every direction, real pandemonium front, rear, and on both flanks. I flopped down on the second of the beach's three terraces next to a warrant officer named Joe Bush, who commanded our rocket section. Joe and I started to dig in right there, in part because the fire was increasing and in part because we needed to gain our bearings before moving forward, something we knew we had to do and fast. I didn't know where our command post, CP, would be, as I could find neither Colonel Liversedge nor Lieutenant Colonel Williams. We needed one of them to set up the CP to run the fight. Anyway, Joe and I were there not more than a minute or two when a few rounds from a Japanese machine gun went stitch, 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 about a foot and a half in front of us. My first thought was, isn't this strange? They're shooting at us. But this wasn't exactly true. They were just firing in every direction, and these particular rounds, well, they came pretty close to severing our heads. I thought of Kipling's old ballad, Gunga Din. It was din, 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 with bullets kicking dust spots on the green. I also remember thinking that maybe I'd made the wrong career move. I'd been active in the church around that time and had thought about joining the priesthood. I soon had other causes for concern. Colonel Williams had suggested I get a couple of extra sandwiches from the ship's galley the previous night, as we weren't likely to get anything decent by way of chow on the first day ashore. So I did just that, but the sandwiches were lost somewhere on the beach, probably not far from where those machine gun rounds landed. The next thing that happened was very grim, but it was the sort of event that was happening up and down that beach all day. And although I wasn't aware of it at the time, it turned out to be a gruesome metaphor for the entire 36-day battle. An artillery round must have blown a couple of Marines to bits to our left, and a foot and a part of a calf, with legging and combat shoe attached, landed just a few meters away. I told one of our runners, a former Trappist monk novitiate named Len Volkowski, Take that over to the regimental surgeon at the aid station. Maybe he can match it to a casualty. Fred Haines pauses for a moment and takes a long, hard look up and down the beach, and then faces south to the mountain. He spoke slowly, a slight hint of emotion in his Texas drawl. The intensity of the combat on Iwo was governed by the very close confinement of the battlefield and the sheer density of the fortifications on the island. Within a couple of days on that little rock, Iwo Jima is only about 8.5 square miles. We had 100,000 men trying with the utmost resolve to kill one another. That's more than 10,000 men per square mile. The Marines had been in some horrific fighting and suffered heavy casualties in World War I and on island battlefields in the Pacific in World War II. But what happened on Iwo was beyond description. It was a close-in slugging match of Marine infantry against hundreds of mutually reinforcing, heavily fortified positions manned by soldiers who preferred death to surrender, even when surrounded and with no hope of escape. It was a battle of Marine flesh against Japanese concrete in a very real sense. This slugging match went on day after day for 5 weeks. We had trained hard for close to a full year as a combat team. That's about double the time a typical Marine unit would spend in preparation for an operation in World War II. We knew our business. The Japanese surely knew theirs.
We've just heard The Lions of Iwo Jima by retired Marine Corps Major General Fred Haines with James Warren. In combat, men measure up, or don't. There are no second chances. Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan, by Sean Parnell with John Bruning, is a vivid account of the U.S. Army's legendary 10th Mountain Division's heroic stand in Afghanistan. Captain Parnell shares an action-packed story of triumph, tragedy, and the extraordinary bonds forged in battle. At age 24, U.S. Army Ranger Parnell was named commander of a 40-man elite infantry platoon, a unit that came to be known as the Outlaws. Parnell and his men assumed they would be facing a ragtag bunch of civilians, but in May 2006, what started out as a routine patrol through the lower mountains of the Hindu Kush became a brutal ambush. Barely surviving the attack, Parnell's men now realized they faced the most professional and seasoned force of light infantry the U.S. Army had encountered since the end of World War II. What followed was 16 months of close combat, over the course of which the platoon became Parnell's family. But the cost of battle was high for these men. Over 80% were wounded in action, putting their casualty rate among the highest since Gettysburg. Ray Porter narrates an unforgettable story of friendship in battle.
Towering mountains, their rocky cliffs wrinkled like an old man's face, flanked the red-brown flatlands where not a road could be seen. Here the earth was untransformed by human endeavor. I found beauty in its pristine hostility. It was perhaps the last place on the planet that had defied the efforts of men. I found it lonely, too. I wished my men were with me in this helicopter. Our battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Toner, had ordered us platoon leaders to fly out a few days ahead of our men to our assigned base on the Pakistani border. We were to be briefed by the unit we were replacing, learn the area, and prepare the way for our platoon's arrival. After the orientation, we would begin combat operations. In the meantime, a hollow sense of loneliness remained ever present. I was sitting in the back of a Boeing CH-47 Chinook, the venerable flying banana that harkened back to the Vietnam War. The airframe of that bird was older than I was. 80 feet long and powered by 2 jet engines mounted on the back pylon, the Chinook looked about as aerodynamic as a metropolitan transit bus with rotors. We entered and exited via an aluminum ramp in the back of the cargo bay. The Chinook crews were a breed apart. They usually flew with the ramp down and the flight engineer sitting on the end of it, like a kid fishing off an old dock, except instead of a pole and Zebco reel, he wielded an M240 machine gun capable of spewing out up to 950 bullets a minute. In an age of Mach 2 jets and satellite-guided munitions, going to war at about 90 miles an hour with your feet dangling in space seemed old-school hardcore. Beyond the flight engineer, the ranks of ridges marched out behind us. 2 months before, I had been home in Pittsburgh enjoying Christmas with my family. My 6-year-old cousin, Freddie, was hovering close. He had been in a strange mood all morning, alternating between excitement over gifts and anxiety over my pending departure. Finally, in the midst of present opening, he asked, "Sean, are you going to die over there?" Leave it to a kid to voice what everyone was thinking. The hubbub drained away, replaced by a shocked, uneasy silence. I had pulled Freddie close. "No, no, I'll see you next Christmas. I'll be fine." My Italian grandfather, Frederick Sciulli, whose fingerless right hand, the result of a childhood fireworks accident, had never ceased to fascinate me as a kid, observed the moment with somber eyes. He'd never missed a day of work in 50 years, but after retiring, his health had finally started to fail, and he had spent much of the fall in the local ICU. Only a few days before Christmas, he'd been released from the hospital, and we were all in the mood to celebrate that. "Sean," he said softly, "you just be careful." How does an infantry platoon leader respond to that? It is our job to set the example in combat, and that meant I would have to take risks, expose myself, and place myself in the center of any fight we found ourselves in. Freddie had squirmed out of my arms and pounced on a gift. I remember watching him send strips of wrapping paper flying and smiling at his innocent enthusiasm.
We've just heard Outlaw Platoon by Sean Parnell.
And now a message from Dr. Daniel Amen, Medical Director and CEO of the Amen Clinics.
If you or a loved one is struggling with ADD, anxiety, depression, overeating, or addictions, we can help. These are all brain-based disorders. And when people seek help, no one looks at their brains. But it is your brain that pushes you away from the table and controls your mood, temper, and focus. Over the last 21 years, Amen Clinics has pioneered the use of brain SPECT imaging to help us diagnose and treat our patients. The scans help us personalize treatment to your brain. And when used in combination with a clinical assessment, our success rate is very high. In a large 6-month outcome study, 8 out of 10 patients reported high levels of improvement.
Call 888-932-6376 to receive a savings of $580 on a full evaluation through November 30th. Interest-free financing is available. That's 888-932-6376.
And now, the book report will take a look back at 18th century military history. The Black Count, Glory, Revolution, Betrayal, and the Real Count of Monte Cristo by Tom Rice brings to life one of history's great forgotten heroes. His swashbuckling exploits appear in The Three Musketeers, and his triumphs and ultimate tragic fate inspired the Count of Monte Cristo. His name is Alex Dumas, father of the novelist Alexandre Dumas. Born to a black slave mother and a fugitive white French nobleman in Saint-Domingue, present-day Haiti, Alex, who had briefly been sold into bondage, was able to make his way to Paris, where he was schooled as a sword-fighting member of the French aristocracy. He was only 32 when he was given command of 53,000 men, the reward for a series of triumphs that many regarded as impossible. He then topped his previous feats by leading a raid up a frozen cliff face that secured the Alps for France. It was after his subsequent heroic service as Napoleon's cavalry commander that Dumas was captured and cast into a dungeon, a harrowing ordeal that inspired one of the world's classic works of fiction. The Black Count is simultaneously a riveting adventure story, a lushly textured look at 18th century France, and a window into the modern world's first multiracial society. Drawing on hitherto unknown documents, letters, battlefield reports, and Dumas' handwritten prison diary, The Black Count is a groundbreaking book of narrative nonfiction. Paul Michael narrates.
And where does God live?
He lives in heaven. I thought hard about this for a minute. Even as a young child, even deprived of reason, I understood that something irreversible had happened in my life. Then, taking advantage of the first moment when they stopped paying attention to me, I got away from my uncle's and ran straight to my mother's house. All the doors were open. All the faces were frightened. One felt that death was there. I went in without anyone's noticing or seeing me. I found a little room where the weapons were kept. I shouldered a gun that belonged to my father, and which he had often promised to give me when I got older. Then, armed with this gun, I climbed the stairs. On the second floor, I met my mother on the landing. She had just left the death chamber. Her face was wet with tears. "Where are you going?" she asked me, surprised to see me there when she thought I was at my uncle's.
"I'm going to heaven," I replied. "What do you mean you're going to heaven? Let me pass." "And what will you do in heaven, my poor child?" "I'm going there to kill God, who killed Daddy."
My mother seized me in her arms, squeezing me so tight I thought I would suffocate. Alexandre Dumas wrote those lines when he had just turned 45 and had decided it was time to reflect on his life. He never got past chronicling his 31st year, which was well before he had published a word as a novelist. Yet he spent more than the first 200 pages on a story that is as fantastic as any of his novels, the life of his father, General Alexandre Alex Dumas, a black man from the colonies who narrowly survived the French Revolution and rose to command 50,000 men. The chapters about General Dumas are drawn from reminiscences of his mother and his father's friends, and from official documents and letters he obtained from his mother and the French Ministry of War. It is a raw and poignant attempt at biography, full of gaps, omissions, and recreations of scenes and dialogue. But it is sincere. The story of his father ends with this scene of his death, the point at which the novelist begins his own life story. For anyone skeptical that a boy so young could recall such details, Dumas responded through the lips of the character Aide, a white slave in The Count of Monte Cristo. Aide's father died when she was 4, betrayed and murdered by one of the main villains in the novel. After speaking movingly of her father, she tells the Count, "I was 4 years old, but as the events held a supreme importance for me, not one detail has left my mind. Not one feature has escaped from my memory."
That was The Black Count by Tom Rice. On November 4, 1979, Iranian militants stormed the American embassy in Tehran and captured dozens of American hostages, sparking a 444-day ordeal. But there's a little-known footnote to the crisis. 6 Americans escaped. A mid-level agent named Antonio Mendez devised an ingenious yet incredibly risky plan to rescue them. And yes, this is the true story behind the new film starring Ben Affleck, Alan Arkin, and John Goodman. Argo, How the CIA and Hollywood Pulled Off the Most Audacious Rescue in History, written by Mendez with Matt Baglio, tells the tale of Mendez and an unlikely team of CIA agents and Hollywood insiders, people who traveled to Tehran under the guise of scouting locations for a fake film called Argo. While pretending to find the perfect scenery and backdrops, the team succeeded in contacting the escapees and smuggling them out of Iran without a single shot being fired. Dylan Baker narrates.
The call went out over the radio network a little after 10 o'clock in the morning. Recall! Recall! All Marines to Post 1! The voice was that of Al Golichinsky, the chief security officer of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. The date was November 4th, 1979, and a large crowd of militant students had just broken through the front gates and was pouring into the compound. The embassy was massive. It took up nearly 27 acres and was surrounded by a high brick wall. Inside there were dozens of buildings and warehouses, the ambassador's residence, an athletic field, tennis courts, even a swimming pool. In addition, the compound was located right in the heart of downtown Tehran and was bordered on all sides by some of the city's most heavily trafficked streets. When you added it all up, it meant that the embassy was a security nightmare. Nearly a dozen U.S. Marines were stationed at the compound, but their job was mainly to provide internal protection. For this reason, the security plan hatched by Golichinsky called for all personnel to head toward the Chancery, a large three-story building that had been fortified with window grills, blast shields, and time-coded locks. The second floor could be sealed off by a thick steel door, which would theoretically allow the Americans to hold out for several hours. Every embassy in the world is dependent on the host government to provide external security, and it was hoped that these precautions would give the Iranian government enough time to organize a response and send help. The embassy had been attacked once before, 9 months previously, on February 14, 1979, just 1 month after Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran, had fled the country. During that attack, a group of Marxist guerrillas had stormed the embassy in a hail of gunfire and held the staffers hostage for 4 hours. At the time, Iran was a chaotic mess. The Ayatollah Khomeini had returned triumphantly from exile in Paris, and the Shah's government had quickly collapsed. The army soon followed suit, and in the vacuum, the diverse factions who had banded together to oust the Shah, leftists, nationalists, Soviet-sponsored communists, hardline Islamicists, had splintered and were now fighting it out among each other. Armed men roamed the streets and revenge killings were rampant. Small gangs called committees, sprang up across the country, carving out territories of control. Beholden to no one except whatever mullah they claimed allegiance to, these gangs amounted to little more than thugs and began enforcing their own brand of revolutionary justice at the barrel of a gun. Amid this confusion, Khomeini and his inner circle had installed a provisional government to manage the country while the assembly of experts worked diligently behind the scenes to draft a new constitution. It wasn't long before the provisional government had sent a ragtag group of men to kick the occupiers out. But the Valentine's Day takeover would have important repercussions for the events to follow. For one, the U.S. Embassy staff was drastically reduced. At full strength, the embassy employed nearly 1,000 people.
We've just heard Argo by Antonio Mendez and Mac Balio. Readers, Veterans Day is on November 11th because that's the day the armistice to end the First World War, or the war to end all wars, was signed. Unfortunately, more wars have followed. I hope you found a title or two in the show you'd like to read. Thanks so much for joining us in this Veterans Day salute, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.